Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today I have Katherine Arden on the show to discuss The Warm Hands of Ghosts, her latest book that explores historical horror set during World War I. We discuss ghosts and memory, common ground with fantasy and horror, and her thoughts on the early 20th century and steampunk. I have Katherine's books in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide at bookshop.org/shop/sheworeblack. If you want another way to help out my show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, Katherine Arden, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to see you a second time after seeing you at Book People here in Austin.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be chatting with you tonight.
I was so pleased that so many people came out for that event. I mean, I'm not surprised, but I'm very, very pleased. And I think that speaks to, people's interest in seeing, you know, a fantasy author also write in horror. Can you go ahead and intro The Warm Hands of Ghosts for anybody who might not be aware of what this book is?
Yeah, well, to back up a little bit, I write fantasy and horror for adults and for children. The Warm Hands of Ghosts is my newest novel, a little bit of a departure. It is, I would probably argue, more of historical fiction with like a flavor of horror and a flavor of fantasy. And I've always been a huge fan of historical fantasy and historical horror as a consumer of books and movies. And it's been great to write in the genre that I enjoy so much. The Warm Hands of Ghosts is set during the First World War, the last year of the conflict, and the main character is a Canadian combat nurse who has been invalided home after an injury. She lives in Halifax, Nova Scotia. At home, she learns that her brother, who is a soldier in the Canadian Army, has gone missing, and she finds a way to return to the conflict in order to find out what happened to him.
Well, kind of going back to what we were just saying, because you are an author of many books, and most famously, the Winter Night Trilogy, which is a fantasy series, but it doesn't shy away from horror in that series. And the series you had before that, Small Spaces, is also horror. Like, that's just straight horror, I think. Can you tell us about the experience of writing both genres and what elements most complement each other for you as a writer?
I mean, I feel like horror and fantasy are very complementary as different genres. A lot of horror trades in the fantastical, whether it's curses or demons or whatever the sort of thing you're interested in, ghosts. And I think in both the case of horror and a fantasy, we use the fantastical or the imagined to help us make sense of our own lives. And in horror, I think you focus more on like the dark parts. Whereas fantasy can be more of a wider range, but I think they're two very complementary genres. And I think in both cases, and I guess in writing altogether, the goal should be to create an atmosphere and to build a world and to set a mood for your reader. And especially in horror, the mood is everything, right? The pacing, the sense of dread. But in fantasy too, a reader wants to be taken away. And feel like they've gone elsewhere. And that's a function of, I mean, ideally immersive writing and careful world building. And it's one of the challenges I enjoy most about being a writer is trying to give someone a sense of place.
The truth of the matter is, I feel like high stakes have always been important with fantasy. I mean, I know there's a cozy horror or cozy fantasy is very popular right now, but and I know that that's kind of, you know, you go back and look at Terry Pratchett and everything, it's always existed. But
and then the aftermath in The Return of the King, when the hobbits go home and everything is mechanical, I think it speaks to his, you know, his fear of a world mechanized and what he's seen of mechanized warfare. So because like you can have the most world-ending plot like Save the Galaxy, but people won't care unless the stakes are personal somehow to the characters, and that's true of any kind of writing. And Lord of the Rings, yeah, of course, Middle Earth's at risk, but we care about what happens to Frodo and Sam. We care about what happens to Aragorn. Like, it's not the end of the world we care about, it's the end of our characters. And I think that's, again, good writing brings people in and makes them care, not about a big conflict, but about the micro problems of characters. And ideally, what you want to do is make one character's experiences a lens through which you can show a whole world.
And going back to what you just said a moment ago, I mean, all of this is true for romance too. I think people don't expect that their high stakes can be explored and horror can be explored. I mean, again, more recently now people are interested in it, but when you go back and look at everything from like Gothic romance going all the way back, I mean, that goes back decades, if not more. And so it is interesting when you explore how all of the genre blending has always been there. And I find it interesting also when we're dealing with speculative elements in that context, when the dread is speculative.
I mean, genre is very arbitrary. There's like general things like if it scares you, it's probably horror. If there's a happily ever after, it's probably a romance. But like, and you know, the conventions go back to like the comedy tragedy, like history trio that Shakespeare worked in, right? Or like even the Greeks go back further back. I think interesting things happen when you understand your conventions and then change them or discard them. And no one not to, too. Like, nobody wants a romance novel where the hero and heroine don't get together. So there are conventions that are there for a reason and that readers won't accept to have broken.
Well, I love that you mentioned Lord of the Rings. I saw that you wrote somewhere, you referenced that in your context of inspiration. And the next question I had for you was also a question about All Quiet on the Western Front, which I remember reading in high school as the first time I ever read a story where it was another point of, like, the opposite point of view in a war.
Like from the German side, you mean? Or, okay, yeah.
I had never, I was 15. I had never read that before. And it wasn't a required reading. That was just something I picked up because I thought it looked interesting. And I know that that book was banned in Nazi Germany because of its unflattering portrayal of war and the German experience. And was this book in any way an inspiration to you as you were writing? And do you think our historical distance gives us more room to explore this particular war in story?
I mean, All Quiet on the Western Front throws an enormously long shadow over all World War I fiction. It's like the grandfather. And the overriding atmosphere of that book, which is this heavy disillusionment with the hope and the promise of Europe in the 19th century, I think has pervaded other work ever since. Was I inspired by it? I mean, I think everyone who writes a World War I novel has read All Quiet on the Western Front. I was more inspired by other books, I think I would say. I was inspired by Faust and by the Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. I was inspired by Paradise Lost. I was inspired by a lot of memoirs. I read tons of them when I was researching. I think just in general, World War One has distance made it easier to process World War One. In some ways, no. Because it's one of those things that was so traumatic for people individually and also for societies, that so traumatic and so futile that in some ways it's like, what do you say? With World War II, you can construct triumphant narratives. You can say, but yes, the good guys prevailed. You can say, like Nazism failed. Right, so you can construct this sort of positive end to everything. World War I, like everyone lost, everyone lost, and it didn't have to be that way. Like Europeans, thought of themselves as the sort of pinnacle of civilization. Like they had this enormous self-satisfaction, this wealth going into the 20th century, and they just decided that it was cool to like send their kids to live in holes for 4 years and murder each other. And that kind of trauma, there's no lesson there. It's just, there really isn't. I mean, don't do it, I guess, is a lesson, but you can't one thing about novels is or just making narrative, you need to go from one place to another. Like you need to have a growth or a birth or a transformation. And the difficulty in writing World War One fiction is it was just bad. Like it was just the height of hubris and futility. And it makes it hard to pull fiction, pull narrative out of this.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned Faust and the Master of Margarita. And I wasn't quite too, I mean, I'm trying to avoid spoilers, so I'm not going to get into certain things, but I was like, yes, I love that she said that. but something I heard you mention, or I don't know how it came up in Austin when you came to visit, was that you've explained this period as steampunk, or as close to historical science fiction as we can get. Can you elaborate on that?
I mean, it was a time when, Dan Carlin on his fantastic podcast about World War One called Blueprint for Armageddon described the war years in the historical estuary when the 19th century and the 20th century collided violently. And if you look at it, it has this incredible mashup of sort of 19th and 20th century aesthetics, beliefs, technologies just coexisting. For example, you had artillery that could fire, 50 miles, 75 miles, but you can't talk the guy in the next trench. You don't have a radio. People are bringing messenger pigeons into battle with them. You have cavalry charging tanks, combat nurses in corsets. You have experimental suits of armor. And if you think about it, like, when did the Wright brothers fly? Was it 1907? I think it was Kitty Hawk, 1907. By 1916, you have combat aircraft. You have people going up in planes, having dogfights in the air. It's just the pace of change and the scale of change were unprecedented. And the kind of, for me at least, the resulting aesthetic was very steampunk. It was very historical science fiction. And obviously your mileage may vary, but that was something that I kept going back to in kind of thinking about the war.
Cavalry charging tanks is a pretty powerful image. You said that.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, even with things like medicine too, which when you look at people that kind of collect or museums that have like old antique medical things, they do look very steampunk. When you look at braces, when you look at shots, when you look at, the way that they handled bodies in the wake of death, it's what they used. It all has that feel to it, as you said, with like the pace of progress, but they're also clearly of its time.
A lot of medical advances came out of the war. It's an interesting topic that has been covered extensively, but blood banking, blood transfusions were a World War One innovation, mobile x-rays, huge advances in wound care and antiseptics, facial reconstruction and plastic surgery. So there was a lot of progress, I guess you could say, in medical fields. But it came at the cost of people's lives, right? But it is a takeaway from the war is the medical advances that we still depend on today.
There's an excellent podcast for anybody listening called Sawbones. And if anybody, and they've talked about this in a few different ways, but Sawbones is a woman who's a doctor and her husband's a comedian. So they talk about medical things and it's very accessible and she's the serious scientist and he brings the funnies, but,
nice.
but it is a fun podcast to listen to. And they've talked about this too. And I just find it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
You've said a few things here where the imagery is going to stick with me for a while. But something that you did in here that I thought was really interesting in your book was that you tackle memory and this question of the value of memory when the particular memories are horrid. You have ghosts, which to me is another form of memory. And all of this made me think, of course, of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and the things that they grapple with. There. And then it also made me think about like our digital age where what we share with others stops being ours. And so then there's this question of, well, what do we keep what do we set free, if you will. And I'm just sort of interested in you, in hearing what your thoughts are on this concept and how you explore, like what you were thinking about as you explored this in your novel, because it is an important, it's an important aspect of your book.
I mean, it's hard to talk about memory in the novel without giving away spoilers, but a big topic in the book is trauma. I guess you call it PTSD, although they wouldn't have at the time. And how you, we'll go back a little bit. So when I was conceiving this book, I, in doing my research, came across a lot of different people who refer to the world, the war, in apocalyptic terms. Right? They called it Armageddon. They called it the apocalypse. They called it, you know, that they would sort of make specific biblical references. Like there were four horsemen, there was death and famine, disease, all this stuff. And my sort of way of framing the war in the book is sort of as the end of the world. And one of the big questions the book asks is, what do people do and how do they go on sort of after the end of everything? And one avenue that by which that's explored is through memory. Because what do your memories mean when all of their significance has changed? Because people would come back from war and they'd remember their lives from before, but it wouldn't matter in the same way. Like the significance of things they used to value and find hope in and treasure and need had just changed. And that's kind of a question, a concept that are explored in the book.
Yeah. I love this idea of memory and all of that. Also, metaphorically, ghosts work really well with that. And that's one of the things, I mean, I love a ghost story, and several, like many times when you read it, a ghost story, this is kind of a theme that happens. And it's interesting when dread comes from within, because that's what memory is, especially in this context. But it is a fascinating thing that I thought you covered really well.
Thank you. I mean, it's something that interested me. How, not just like, I mean, war is war, but what it does to people's minds. And one of the things that horror and fantasy can do is it can literalize abstracts. And the great thing about being able to embody or literalize an abstract is that you can talk to it. It can manipulate you, you can play it, it can be interrogated in a way that it can't be in real life. It's one of the great advantages of being able to write in the speculative space is you can give voice to concepts that don't have a voice, that just are.
I just interviewed Gwendolyn Keist about her book, The Haunting of Velkwood, and it does similar work. But it's funny because it's similar work in a completely different time and a completely different context. But it's that whole idea of, is it a ghost or is it memory, or it, like, what's the work happening here? And it's just a fascinating thing. I think horror is like such a rich place to explore all of that.
Well, I'm a huge horror fan. I think it's a fantastic genre, and I'm absolutely a horror junkie. So I come from that space when I'm writing my own work.
Well, something that I'm sure you've been asked before, but winter clearly has meaning for you. And it's funny because Texas still claims you, even though you've moved to northern temperatures in northern places. You write about cold and snowy climates quite a bit. And your last trilogy is called Winter Night, and an important character in this book is named Hans Winter. What is the significance or appeal for you that keeps drawing you back?
Just like winter. I mean, I like all the seasons. The character in the new book is winter, in part because it's easier to say for an English speaking audience. So I went with it. Sometimes I saw a meme recently where it was like, some names have deep symbolic significance for characters. Some names you just liked. And I would say in Warm Hands of Ghosts, naming a character Hans Winter was in the latter category of this seems nice. I mean, I love winter at home. I love to ski. When I was working on my first trilogy, which was set in medieval Russia, winter kind of necessarily became a character because of the setting. But I wouldn't say it was so much me like being super into winter as me being just sort of really into atmosphere.
Were you living
in atmospheric
Austin?
Writing.
Were you living in Austin when you wrote that trilogy, though?
I was living in Hawaii.
Oh, even that's so it's warm because see, yeah. In Texas, as you know, I mean, we just I in the summer I read winter books because I'm just like, I can't read anything warm. Mm-hmm. I'm already hot. You know, I thought perhaps that played a part. So I was just curious. Well, what can you tell us about what you have coming up next?
I wrote a picture book for little kids, cute. Which was a fun side project for me, but it's out in September. It's called The Strangest Fish. It's about a little girl who wins a goldfish at a county fair, and it turns out to be magical. And it was extremely fun to write. The illustrations are by a wonderful artist named Zara Marwan, and they're absolutely gorgeous. And I am excited to have a new book in a different, sort of totally different space for me. And then I'm working on a couple of projects, both for adults and for children. So those are also in sight.
Okay. Well, we'll just be on the lookout for those. And of course, I'll post anything whenever announcements are made and everything.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. We're looking, well, you've got, I mean, your fans are fans for a reason. We love what you do. So thank you so much for coming to talk about your work on the show.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today. And happy reading.